com.
Great. And I will, for our podcast listeners, I'll include all those links and more in our show notes. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today. I really learned a lot, and I think it's so fascinating. So among many other titles and roles that these two both have, Joe Liebezeit is staff scientist for the Portland Audubon Society, and Shannon Souza is policy director for Pacific Ocean Energy Trust. Thank you both for joining me today. And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Coast Range Radio today. You can find this and all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts or at our website, coastrange.org. That's coastrange.org. Please rate and review this show on your podcast app, tell a friend, and see show notes for more resources. I love hearing feedback and suggestions for future shows and guests, and you can email me at Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, at coastrange.org. That's our show. Thanks again, and talk to you soon.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel, how are you doing?
Hi, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the Zoom, we have Erica Strauss-Shavaria and Sobia Sheikh. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So would you just start by telling us what you do as educators, where you work?
So up until about 2 weeks ago, I taught high school Spanish at in Howard County, Maryland. I taught at the same school that I graduated from and was in the same classroom for all those years. And now I recently transferred to or transitioned to become the executive director of a organization that I started in March 2020. Called Columbia Community Care. So looking at different types of education outside of the school system. So that is where I am now.
Gotcha.
I'm a high school math teacher in Everett. And for the last 7 years, and now I'm taking a break away from teaching for a year to learn about UNISERV directors. So I'm interning in Seattle as a UNISERV director.
Okay, yes. So you're both going through some transitions right now with your work. And what inspired you to go into education? We always ask this question for our guests.
I always wanted to be a teacher when I was younger. I had a passion for learning. And this passion started back when I was in Pakistan. And I continued to pursue that as I was going through high school and college, despite my community telling me, don't do this, there's not enough respect, there's not enough pay. But I was like determined to go become a teacher.
I actually tried to avoid the education profession for a long time. Uh-huh. I didn't have the greatest experience as a student and got in a lot of trouble. I started protests in high school. I got suspended. Just wasn't the top student by any means, although I was really smart and a critical thinker. But my mom was an educator, and I really was trying to find a different profession that wasn't education, because I wanted to do something differently combined with my not so great experience in school. And then after a while, after, you know, venturing down different career paths, I realized that I could combine my passion for Spanish language and culture, as well as my human rights background, into education. And so I realized that that was actually the profession I did want to pursue, because I wanted to give students a space and an experience that I didn't have as a student. And so I realized that that's actually where I should be.
Gotcha. And both of you also hold union office, although I don't, that may be transitioning as well, but talk about the union office that you hold or that you have held, and what motivated you to do that, or what inspired you to get involved with your union and hold an office?
Well, I actually, funny enough, I mentioned that I started protests in high school, and it was really over racist policies that they were attempting to pass. And a teacher that was at the school at the time that was kind of supporting the young people with that movement was a teacher at the school when I became a teacher, and she remembered me. And when she first saw me, she said, "Union, go," and basically like pushed me into becoming a building rep. And I was pretty involved in my local until I was vehemently against the rampant racism that I saw happening in my local, and I wanted to be completely apart from that. So I left local anything union related, but I still was I wanted to serve on the national level. And so I was an NEA director for the past 5 years. I still have one more year on my term, but obviously since I transitioned out of public school, I'm no longer serving that last year. And I also, because I was on the national board representing Maryland, I was also required to serve on the state board. So I was on the Maryland State Education Association's Board of Directors and the National Education Association's Board of Directors for 5 years.
Gotcha.
So I had no idea what unions were before I started teaching. It was my first year I became a building rep because a colleague asked me to. She was like, just follow me to the meetings and you'll learn. And that's when I learned about unions. And through that, I learned about, you know, what unions do, what our contract meant. And then I held some positions at the state level through committees. So I was on the Human and Civil Rights Committee. From my union, we held our teaching equity conferences. And then the last 2 years, I served on the NEA board. Like Erica said, through NEA, I also served on my state board.
Great.
Well, we invited you on the show because the annual National Education Association's Representative Assembly took place recently. And some interesting and amazing things happened, and you were both there and involved in some of those things. The main thing we wanted you to talk about were the efforts to pass something in support of the Palestinian people. But before we get to that, for our listeners who might not understand, why do you think it's important for unions to take positions that support the Palestinian people? And what does it have to do specifically with educators?
Tobia, you want to go first?
I was waiting for you to go first.
Oh, okay. I can go. It doesn't matter. I think that, you know, everything that education is inherently political. And if anyone thinks otherwise, they're sorely mistaken. We have Palestinian students and educators and families in our classrooms. And until the students and families and educators that we are involved with are affirmed and uplifted in their identity and who they are and feel safe in our classrooms and feel safe in our school communities, this is, it's absolutely an education issue. We cannot deny that. And, you know, we as an education union have really done the work and pushed very hard to tackle the issues of systemic racism. And this is an issue of systemic racism. This is an issue of imperialism and colonialism. And we owe it to our young people, our students, and Palestinian families to tell the truth about what's happening and to make sure that their identities are affirmed and that they feel safe, cared for, and loved in our school communities.
I'm going to add on to that, answering that second question. When we talk about teaching the whole child, you know, it's the whole child, including their histories, their backgrounds, their culture, and like Erica said, you know, affirming their identities. And you know, what does that have to do with educators? As educators, it is our responsibility to educate ourselves. We hear a lot of educators saying, oh, we don't get involved with this because I don't know what's going on, you know, in the Middle East, and I don't wanna get involved in that. And it's like, this is an opportunity to educate yourself. You know, start having those conversations, especially with Palestinian folks and people who are fighting for human rights issues, because really you're going to take that into your classroom. And if, again, it becomes teaching the whole child. And how do you teach the whole child if you don't understand their culture and their background?
Thank you. There were three proposals called new business items brought to the floor of the assembly. Could you tell our listeners what the three proposals were specifically?
I believe the first one had to do with educating around Palestinian students.
And then the second one was about highlighting students and members who are through digital communication that already exists through NEA, but highlighting members that are doing the work and advocating for Palestinian students and their families, and highlighting Palestinian students, educators, and those who are advocating for Palestinian students and educators in already existing digital channels.
And then the third one was protecting those members who are doing that work, because there have been members who have received death threats, they've received harassment, intimidation, so the NBI came out of that.
Great. And can you tell us about what happened with the first one, the one about educating our members and students?
I believe that was the first MBI of the entire representative assembly. It did fail, although frustratingly there were, that was so because that was the first MBI and we were on a new platform of technology. I'm not 100% sure that there were not tech issues involved with that MBI, but it did fail. The first one failed.
You know, just thinking about last year and 4 years ago when it was my first NEARA, people weren't even willing to have these conversations. It was like immediate shutdown. But to see that there was a debate this time, we had a lot of people speak in favor of this. There were a lot more support this time around than last year or even 4 years when I first attended my RA.
And just as a follow-up, did this one, how close was the vote for this one? Do you remember if it if it failed by a little or larger margin, or
I don't remember the exact number, the percentage, but I do believe it was significantly closer than anything we have seen thus far since then in any past RAs, the way what Sylvia was describing. And I appreciate you mentioning that, because my original thought was it failed, but you're right. I mean, we did have so many more speakers in favor. We had a lot of support. I think it was definitely, although it didn't pass, it was definitely a success in that the conversations are becoming more normalized around this topic. And the immediate gut reaction to oppose is not as prevalent any longer. And so I think, without remembering the exact percentage, I don't think I think it was pretty close, to be honest. I think it was maybe like a 60-40, which is much better than we've seen before.
Yeah. And just to set the stage for our listeners, there were a little over 3,000, I think, or so delegates in the convention center there, and then maybe another 1,000 or more that were attending virtually. So it's a pretty big group of people. What about the second NBI, the one about highlighting members? What do you remember, or what happened with that one?
The second one was there was a motion, a substitute motion made to refer to the committee. That means that it goes to the leadership and leadership decides what to do with that NBI. And that vote was 50-50 with, I think, Knows had like 28 more votes than the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I believe, actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that, so I don't remember if that one was bundled, was attempted to be bundled, or if it was the third one.
From the article I read, they were trying to refer all three of them to committee.
Okay, yeah. So I think that there was an attempt to bundle and refer in combination with two other NBIs, or a couple other NBIs that had nothing to do with the Palestinian ones. And that motion failed, thank goodness. So that was a step in the right direction. And then there was the substitute motion to refer that one to committee, and it did get the 50-50 with the 28 votes or 22 vote difference.
Yeah, so super close, barely didn't pass. Okay.
Before you go to the third, can you explain to listeners why it's important that these things are not referred to committee?
Yeah, I mean, there's several reasons why. One, these, you know, in looking at a democratic structure or the attempt to have democracy within the voting, you know, structure that we have at NEA, at these representative assemblies, it's really important. We're there to debate topics, so we're there to have these conversations and to discuss. And when you refer to committee, it's much like a teacher just sending a kid to the principal's office without dealing with the own issue themselves. It's really just this idea of pushing off something, avoiding the tough conversations, avoiding the debate, and just sending it off to leadership to decide what to do with it, which would mean that a block of 10 people are making a decision that, you know, 6,000 delegates who have been elected to that position to make these decisions should be making. And so when you do that, it's really just a way of silencing the makers of those NBIs and those voices who are attempting to debate and speak to their, you know, speak their heart. So when you see an attempt to bundle and refer that's not approved by the makers of motions, it's really what's actually happening is that it's just an attempt to silence voices. And so there's another time when you would want to bundle and refer, and that's only if you feel that the time is running out and that your NBIs would not actually make it to the floor, meaning that it wouldn't even have a chance to be debated. And so at any attempt of having any action for those NBIs, sometimes at the very end of the RA, makers of NBIs will bundle on purpose and refer to committee so that at least something happens. But when those decisions are attempted to be made without the maker's approval, that means that it's really just an attempt to silence those people, which is why we, at the previous RA, not this past RA, but the one before that, we, I believe there was a bylaw change or a rules change to not to, anyone who was attempting to bundle had to speak to the makers to approve that bundle first to avoid this type of, to avoid silencing of voices. And although the person attempting to bundle without our approval did so, it should have been ruled out of order, in my opinion, because he did not seek the approval of the makers of any of those MBIs, which was unfortunate, and it still was allowed to be to move forward, which I felt was parlamentary. I didn't feel that that was parliamentary procedure. I thought it should have been ruled out of order to begin with. So we shouldn't have even had to vote on that, in my opinion.
Also, when we bundle and refer, it goes to leadership, and the leadership decides how they want to do this NBI, or they can be like, oh, we're already doing this work, we don't need to do this, or if it doesn't seem feasible, they may not even do this NBI.
All right, so now we get to the third NBI. Talk about what happened with that one.
That was a victory. I think we were super excited. I never in my lifetime thought that I would see the day, that we would see the day when an MBI was passed in favor of anything regarding Palestine. And so the third one, which was to protect members, that NEA is required to protect members who are receiving death threats or threats to their job or, you know, defamation, that they're required to protect those members. And that was a huge victory because we have, as you know, as mentioned before, even just the mere mention of the word Palestine incites death threats. And so the fact that that was passed, and that was a significant percentage margin. I mean, I think that was like a 65 to 35 or something close to that, where it was a solid win. And that was really exciting. And I just remember like a mix of being shocked and crying and just being so excited. And I think, you know, what happened after the NBIs that, you know, with the articles that started coming out that were publishing names and everything like that showed exactly why we needed that NBI to be passed.
I think this NBI was, there was an attempt to refer this to the committee and that actually got shut down by a huge margin. Just again, to their Erica's point, like this is the time to debate and not silence voices. And, you know, people heard that this time and they let the debate continue, and it was like 60-40 when it passed. And it was a historic win. I saw the rhythm maker of the motion for number one, and, you know, she was in tears and she didn't know how to take this. And it was a victory for all of us, especially for you guys who have been doing this work for, you know, several years now.
So many of the arguments against these, all three of these proposals, was that there are human rights issues all over the world and that singling out Israel is unfair and actually anti-Semitic. What is your response to that critique?
This year we're trying to make sure that we only focused on Palestine and Palestine only. You know, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we don't say all lives matter, right? We're just focusing on Black students. If I had put in an NBI that said, like, you know, teach the history of Pakistan, I'm not gonna say, hey, go bring in history of India too, you know. I mean, sure, India's involved, but it was just focus on Pakistan. And that's the same thing with like Palestine. It's, if I wanted you to focus on Palestine and Palestinian students, this is about them, their history and their cultures and their struggles that they have been going through. And I think singling out Israel was wrong and incorrect. And, you know, anytime they see the word Palestine, they're like, oh, anti-Semitism. Just screams out anti-Semitism just because we focused on Palestine.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And I would also add that, you know, unfortunately, you know, one of the makers of the other MBIs told the story of how when she was in school, her teacher told her that Palestine didn't exist when she was going to be doing a project about her own country and culture. And so to have a negation of existence, to say that your that someone's country doesn't exist means that they don't exist. Palestinian people do exist. And so we cannot have that. This is an issue that is an issue regarding racism. And if we are a union that we claim to be focusing on racial justice, then this is another part of racial justice. There is a reason why the Palestinian people find themselves consistently in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. If you look at photography from Palestine, you see images of Black Lives Matter, you see solidarity statements, you see murals of George Floyd. There is a particular feeling of camaraderie between what the Palestinian people are dealing with and struggling for and Black Lives Matter movement. And so to say that it is anti-Semitic inherently to uplift a people that in our own classrooms in this country have been denied their existence. And I have students in Howard County, in my county as well, that have said the same thing, where their teachers are completely either ignorant and do not understand or have any idea about the history of Palestine, the existence of Palestine, the existence of Palestinian people. And when you do that, you are literally destroying a child's identity and a person's identity. And so it is particularly important to focus on you know, these three MBIs were focused on supporting our educators and students that are here, and making sure that when we're looking, like Sophia had mentioned before, the whole child, that we are affirming the existence of these communities here in the United States, Palestinian communities. I myself am Jewish, and although recently somebody actually messaged me and said something about that I'm claiming the one drop rule, I think without even knowing why, which was the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. But I am Jewish, and I believe that speaking out against the injustice of a state, of a country that is doing something to a people, is my duty, particularly as a woman of Jewish heritage, because how can you do unto someone else what was done unto you? It is, you know, my responsibility, my duty as a woman who is Jewish to speak out against the atrocities that I see, but most importantly, you know, when people speak out against the actions of the United States government, it doesn't mean that they're inherently anti-American or that they hate people who live in this country, people from the United States. That's not what we're doing. Calling out the actions of the state of Israel is not anti-Semitic. I do not hate myself and I do not hate my people, but I will by all means call out injustice when I see it, and that includes the injustices that are happening in Palestine. And I think there's a real unfortunate ignorance of the true history of that region, and the fact that there are Jews, Muslims, and Christians that are all Palestinian that have been living on that land in harmony for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years, and that the history of what actually happened in the creation of the state of Israel, people just don't know. Their automatic assumption, even Jewish people don't know the true history and what and the imperialist colonialist roots of it. Is, you know, something that the point of NBI, of the first NBI, NBI 1, was to educate our members about the true history of that region. And so until we are continue to be ignorant to the reality of what the history is, we will continue to, you know, there will be people that will continue to claim that any support of Palestine or Palestinian people is inherently anti-Semitic. And we are just saying that we have had enough of that, not in my name, and that is not the truth.
Wow, thank you. that was very powerful. We have almost no time left, but I would like you to just talk a little bit about, you mentioned earlier about an article that came out naming makers of the proposal and open people up to threats and intimidation. And can you speak just briefly about how NEA leaders and staff responded to that?
I know there was a... organizing effort to censor the member, and I think according to the bylaws you can't censor a member, you can't censor your own member, but I don't think I know there was a statement made by the president, you know, you can't do this stuff. You know, it's a, you're violating someone's privacy and it is against the union values. I think they should have done more than to just tell them you need to cease and desist. I think there should have been a warning of like, hey, we're gonna take away your leadership position or we're gonna take away your membership, right? I don't think the union leaders handled that quite well, or at least not, or at least from what I know. I don't know what Erica wants to add on to that.
Yeah, so I agree. I was appreciative that there was an attorney that pulled several of us aside whose names were released to kind of speak to what they were planning on doing. They did contact the editor of the article, the author of the article, and demanded that they remove our names, which the person did do. But the member that released that information for the article, I believe just received a letter saying stop. And I don't believe that that's, you know, I agree. I don't think that that's far enough at all. I think the other frustrating part of the entire issue is that we attempted multiple times to take a point of personal privilege to explain, to thank our delegation for voting for the third MBI on Palestine about protecting members because of exactly what happened right after, because of that article. And with multiple attempts and multiple people calling in, we were never given that opportunity. And that would have been, you know, we say we're about restorative justice at NEA, and that would have been a perfect opportunity to allow those most affected and harmed to have a voice in how we believed healing